All right, shit shows. Breathe to Heal is officially back, and this time we're going deeper than ever before. The theme of this third round is release and receive, releasing everything that's been stuck for way too long so you can finally receive the peace, love, and safety I know you've been craving. The 7-week healing journey goes beyond talk therapy by working directly with your nervous system using breathwork, somatic practices, and parts work to give you the kind of healing your body has been waiting for. This is all facilitated by fellow shit show member and certified somatic and breathwork practitioner Teresa, who's just added some fresh breathwork certifications to her toolkit. And the best part of all, this all happens right within the shit show healing community. So think of it like a healing journey where you can show up exactly as you are, like you're hanging out with your friends on the couch in your pajamas, instead of feeling like you're in some stuffy environment. So this all kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th, and early bird pricing is on through December 11th. So you, yes you, the person that's been wanting to sign up for the past two rounds but hasn't, how about we do the damn thing already, okay? Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end. adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal to learn more and grab your damn spot. Shit. Well, welcome back to Shit Show Saturday. I've been wanting to have this little lady on for a long time. Welcome, Shit Show Kelly.
Hey.
My opera singing leather maker.
Yeah.
That's got any other good talents that you haven't told me about?
I love to landscape.
You love to landscape.
I love to move rocks, and I'm always dirty when I'm working in my yard. I get filthy and I don't seem to care.
Like move rocks just like for the hell of it?
No, like make
arrange
walkways.
Them. Uh-huh.
Yeah, maybe build a sidewall, make a walkway down a hill, and but I'll have to, they're big, I gotta roll them.
Uh-huh.
So I'm pretty sure I was a landscaper in a previous life because I love doing that.
That's so funny. Okay, what song do you want played when you walk into a room?
All right, so that's an easy one. Lyle Lovett, If I Had a Boat.
If I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, ride him on my boat.
And we could. Perfect. Carbohydrate.
French bread.
Okay. Cheese. Mm-hmm.
Cream cheese. Yeah.
Good choice. Good bathe in it. Condiment.
No condiment.
I mean, you'll never use it under any circumstance.
I'll put ketchup on fries once in a while.
Just for the hell of it?
Just for the hell of it. Yeah. Just because it's weird that I don't like condiments. So sometimes I'll just like switch it up just to keep myself guessing.
But you like peanut butter and jelly.
Love peanut butter and jelly. Do you consider that a condiment? Are those condiments?
I guess jelly is a condiment, I would say.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it counts in a peanut butter and jelly. Like, is it a condiment in that context? No, but.
No, because it becomes something else, right?
It's but what like about
a, it's
butter?
A whole meal.
Butter?
That's kind of a condiment.
I think it is.
Wow, that's a really good point. Like, so I don't do condiments, but yet my favorite dish is peanut butter and jelly, which can be condiments.
Like when you eat bread, you put butter on it? Depends.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like butter on bread. So I never thought of bread as condiment.
Butter. Yeah. Okay. All right. So when did you learn that you were an adult child?
So an adult child, when I was in college, I took a class called the Alcohol Troubled Person, and the professor...
Professor the alcohol a, troubled person.
Yeah.
He wrote like a that book. Was in the 1940s, but you're not that old.
Yeah. So this was, early 90s. The professor had just written a book called The Alcohol Troubled Person, and he opened up a residential treatment facility. I was in one of his classes, and he hired me to work as a substance abuse counselor in that facility. And that's when I learned about ACA, Al-Anon, and adult children. Yeah. But I didn't see myself at the time as an adult child because... This is very rigid, but my father had been moved out of my house by the time I was 4 or 5. So my thinking was I wasn't affected because he didn't live in the house with me. But I now know that he was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I was.
So, well, actually, first, I want to ask you more about this alcohol trouble person. Did he consider that differently than being an alcoholic?
No, he just used a different term. The whole premise, his philosophy was a threefold. It's a social issue, a physical issue, and a genetic issue. And you had to approach it from all three angles. And the residential facility ended up closing pretty soon after it opened because it happened to happen at the same time that insurance companies was getting in on the medical model. And this was like a, they called it a social milieu, if I'm pronouncing that right, milieu, where, you know, you lived in this place and everyone had to go to group together and they went to meetings together and everything was done as a group. But it didn't last, but it was great while it was there.
Wow, that's so interesting.
He lost the funding. Yeah.
What was his name?
Alan Willoughby. Dr. Alan Willoughby.
The alcohol troubled person.
The alcohol troubled person, yeah.
When was the realization that the term was applicable to you?
Somewhere in over the years, I started to like wake up. So what I mean by that is like, I'm just so good at living in a fantasy world. So I got a job, I guess I was in my 40s, and the job was to be a counselor at a high school, but it was a counselor, not a guidance counselor. It was to be a mental health counselor, but my job was to help children in a high school that were living in homes where there was substance abuse, to provide Al-Anon, kind of like have Al-Anon meetings in the school. That was my job.
Wow.
And in doing it, it was became impossible for me to not acknowledge that I was affected when I would talk to them about, you know, the ways they were affected. I could see how it was the same issue for me. I just couldn't. I had trouble accepting it. And I think because I bought my mother's narrative that, you know, she needed to have, because she needed to be an exceptional mother, she had to have exceptional kids. And so I needed to believe that about myself to survive. And I was constantly looking for the proof that I was. But yet everything I was doing and all these decisions I was making was just flying right in the face of my denial.
So would you consider, do you feel like you had an adult child bottom? Would you consider kind of the circumstances that ultimately led you to joining the community? Would you consider everything that happened with your sisters as you hitting a bottom? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So, my mother, when she died 4 years ago, within 6 months, I went no contact with my sisters. Like I never saw it coming, but in hindsight, it made sense. But to do something so drastic, I knew I had to get help, but I wasn't clear as to, I kept thinking that the issue was like, I wasn't managing them well, and I needed to learn how to manage them better. Like believing it's me, but not in the way I've since learned, you know, like I have to, it's the codependency. Like I became addicted to my family of origin. Mm. I did. And I wanted them to show up for me. I wanted them to validate my pain. And every time I failed, I believed I wasn't doing it right. And I would try harder and harder and harder. And, but yeah, I mean, when I went no contact, I knew I needed help. And that's when I started, I went to an Al-Anon meeting, but I met someone there who said, you need to go to ACA. And I started going to ACA meetings. And then one day I was Googling ACA, and that's how I found your podcast. Mm-hmm. And I joined right away. It was the word shit show, because I call myself a shit show in a half a year. Like, I'm a fucking shit show. And it was a no-brainer.
Was there a final straw with going no contact with your sisters, or just a slow burn?
Well, yeah, it was both, really. But there was a final straw. And it was regarding, we had a celebration of life. We were planning it for my mother back here in Rhode Island. She lived in Florida. And my sisters proceeded to tell me who they were not allowing to attend. And they were happened to be family members. And I was not okay with that. And that's all I said. Like, I don't throw my weight around. I just let them know that I'm not okay with that. And proceeded to like trying to find different ways to try to get them to compromise. But they wouldn't compromise. My oldest sister just like refused. She's like, I don't know why you're having trouble accepting this. This is the way it is. This is how it's going to be. You need to grow the hell up and stop coming to me and talking to me about this. She won't compromise. And how do you have a relationship with someone that you feel good about that won't compromise? But she never did. But as long as my mother was alive, I couldn't admit how they could be. For some reason, I couldn't do it until she died. And that's the kind of power that she had over us. And my sisters are still under that illusion. My mother's like, you know, a messiah in death. Mm-hmm. But that was the final straw. They would say it's because like the two people that they wouldn't invite, one of them was a cousin, but this cousin happened to be a really close friend of mine as well. And they would say the reason why no contact is because of my cousin. Well, that's kind of like the platform it all unfolded on. But no, it's, you don't compromise. Like there's no discuss. It's your way. And that's it. And then I started to realize like they always see me as, they see me as not capable. I don't make good decisions. I'm super self-doubt. But it's true. I would defer to them a lot because I was it was like raised to like, well, you know, what do your sisters have to say about that, Kelly? Did you talk to your sisters about that? Like, what do you say? It was always my sisters. So now they just see me as fucked up. And as long as they see me that way, nothing that comes out of my mouth has any value. Nothing. Mm-hmm.
Did you verbalize the no contact, or did you just go no contact?
I sent them a text saying pretty much verbatim, lately, every time we talk, you're either hurting me or I'm hurting you. This is not how I want the kind of relationship I want with you. So for now, I'm ceasing all communication. I said for now, but I had a feeling the only way we could reconnect is if I apologize and reach out to them, because that's what I would always do. They will not reach out. I know they will never reach out to me. I shouldn't say that. My oldest sister will not.
Yeah, I thought one of them reached out to you recently.
My middle sister, she'll send me a card. Like the last card she sent was, I miss you and Sam. It's not the same without you. And then even my husband was like, can you see how she just wants it to go back to the same way it was? She's not even, they've never even asked. Like,
yeah, did they respond to that message, to that text?
My oldest sister's response was, well, the other thing I put in that letter was, I had my mother's ashes. And I said, I've taken some ashes and I'm sending the rest to you. Sam will drop them off. Her response was, oh my God, you have desecrated our mother's rural remains. Her last dying wish was that we put her ashes, bury your ashes with a tree that we plant for her. I'm done with you. I'm never talking to you again. Which was funny because I had already just said that. But that's that narcissism in her. She had to find something so she could spin it to make it look like she was making this happen. She was in control and I was the bad guy.
And so how did it feel like when you did that? Was there relief or what was that adjustment like for you?
There was relief initially. Because I didn't have to deal with them anymore. I don't like saying it, you know, like, there's probably a better way to say it, but it was like, always felt like I was being bullied by them. Mm-hmm. You know, but they were both coming at me from two different directions and in two different ways. And that when that stopped, I did feel relief, but I also slowly started to, I think now as I look back, I started to panic because I deferred to them. Right. I mean, I bought into the narrative about me that I don't make good decisions. I need to bounce everything off of them and I need their feedback. And so I think some part of me started to panic, like, can I do this alone without them? And I know the answer to that, but I still have, like, even now, like, I could cry, like, it just 4 years, right? And I'm still, it just breaks my heart. But what I'm learning with my therapist is that this is something that my mother set in motion. My sisters are also caught in this web. And that's what I'm learning. And it's very difficult because I can't look at my mother and see tangible things, but I can look at my sisters and I have all sorts of shitty memories filled with data that serve as blatant evidence that they are nasty to me. I couldn't say that with my mother because she was so sly. Really, she set it up so they just took over and she just sit back and watched.
So childhood, what do you want to share?
I guess, you know, the thing that is the hardest for me that feeds my shame is when my father would be violent and beat my mother, that's when I started wetting the bed. And it was the enuresis. And it started to happen during the day. She took me to a urologist. And
at what age is this?
5 years old when I started to wet the bed. She took me to a urologist when I was about 7, and they thought it was a good idea to blow up my bladder. They thought my bladder was too small. Well, within a week, now I was urinating. I was pissing my pants. So really, it did the opposite. Like, it actually made it much worse. But that shaded my entire childhood because I couldn't hold it, right? And the sense of urgency that came on, it would, like, cripple me. Like, I'd have to get down on the floor, like, and, you know, like, stick my heel in my crotch so I didn't wet myself. But I invariably would end up doing it anyway because it would be so painful. But the hiding that I did, the hiding of if I wet myself, or just the hiding just in anticipation of it, of my body and something it was doing that I could not control. And I never really realized just how bad it was until my mother died. And now I start really thinking about, well, that was really fucked up. You know, she had to change the bed, the sheets myself every morning and every night. And I had a trundle bed. Do you know what a trundle bed is? Mm-hmm. So I shared a room with my sisters, and I'm small, like, and they're years old, 4 years older than me. But I'm the one that had to pull this bed out, which was on a metal frame. It had this metal lever that you had to lift and flip over. So the bed comes up and locks into place. And I'm the one that was doing that. My sisters are bigger than me and stronger than me, but they're too good for that. They're in normal beds, right? And I'm the one that's got to do that. And that was a theme in my life, right? Like, I got seconds. I got seconds. And I learned to be grateful for that. Like, I never questioned, like, why am I eating hamburger and you've got prime rib? Well, Kelly, you don't like prime rib. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I guess I did. Like, all right, thank God you're here to tell me this. Because there's so much I don't know about me, but you know everything. That was my childhood, you know, just not having a voice and using their voice, listening to their voice. But I could see now, like, that's how that codependence happened. Like, I just became so, my focus was always on my sisters, always. And yet with one of them, she was nasty. She could be physical too. Sometimes she'd like walk by me and she'd take her hand and she'd like do that, like up the side of my head, mm-hmm. just like a swat and say, shut the fuck up. Like if I was talking or something, she was nasty.
So where did your brother fall in line? Like, what was the order of all of you guys?
So my brother's the oldest.
Mm-hmm. And he's how many years older?
He's 6 or 7 years older than me. Okay. 6 years older than me. And they're all a year apart.
Okay. And then you.
Yeah. In childhood, he had, well, he wasn't diagnosed then, but oppositional defiant disorder, then conduct disorder. He certainly had ADHD. He was always in trouble. He had to go to like bad boy school. He was hell on wheels. And he scared me, but he wasn't mean like my oldest sister was. Like, he thought everything he did was hilarious. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he terrorized me, but he's laughing the whole time. So it just created a different kind of experience for me. Like, I was afraid of him in a different way than I was my sister. I think it was like, he didn't want to hurt me. Like, it felt like she did. He just wanted to have a good time. And this is the way he did it.
And then how old were you when your dad left the house?
When he officially left, I think I was about 4. And for a few years, he was kind of in and out. But then when they officially got divorced, I was 7. And we didn't see him for quite a while. A couple of years, I think. We didn't see him at all. Then he'd show up. If we did see him, we'd spend like a Sunday afternoon at the bar with him. But when he left, things got harder, I imagine, for all of us. But definitely for me, because when he was there, my brother and my sister were more subdued. When he was left and everyone knew he wasn't coming back, that's for me when help really began, because my mother was so overwhelmed. Her life was not unfolding the way she wanted. And she had these 4 kids. 2 of them were very difficult. So yeah, childhood was crazy. I was always trying to get out of the house to get away from the chaos that came at me from different angles. Like if it was just coming from one direction, you know, like I could manage that. I could know where, but it came at you from different directions. You just never knew what was going to come at you. So another reason why I think I'm always on the move, I'm always doing something. Because if you're standing in one spot for too long, you know, like something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What would your mom talk about your dad?
She never really badmouthed him. The only time she did was it was always about money. Mm-hmm. He had a company, like he made good money. But he had an oil company. But if he was pissed off at my mother, he wouldn't deliver oil. And if it was the wintertime, like it was cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she wouldn't badmouth him. But she would do things like, you want that? Go talk to your father. You want that? What do I look like? I don't have any money. Go talk to your father. And I never would, because I wanted him to love me. I didn't want to be I'd already internalized being a burden. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wasn't going to do that. Mm. So no, I wouldn't say she badmouthed him. But would she? She did this really strange thing. He had 8 sisters and she went to high school with all of them. And she maintained really close friendships with 3 of them, even after they divorced. Like holidays, we were spent with all my cousins and my aunts and uncles, but this was my father's family. And he was checked out. Like sometimes I wonder like what was going on in all their minds that this, he's got all these sisters, but they're spending time with his ex-wife. I don't know. It's just really bizarre.
And did your mom ever date again?
She did have one boyfriend for a couple of years, but then she ended it abruptly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just one.
Did your mom treat, I know that obviously she treated you differently, but did she treat your sisters differently?
No, my sisters, she treated very much the same. And I guess the only thing that comes to my mind that can like articulate that is once they were like, when they were around 14, so Trish was maybe 14, Lynn was 15, on the weekends, they would go to this underage club and dance. And I can remember on the weekends for a chunk of time, my mother would take pictures of them as they got dressed up to go. And she just made a big deal about how they looked. Like they were tall, they're pretty. And she made a big deal about that. Then she would like drive them to this place. And then I don't remember when she would come back. All I do remember is I needed to hide from my brother. But I also remember thinking when I get older, she's going to pay me that attention, but it never did happen. But I was different. I was gawky. I wasn't into boys. So I never got that kind of attention. But I would watch how she would almost like soliciting them, you know? I think that my mother attached a lot of her worth to if a man loves you, then you have value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does anyone really know what hormones do? Like there's so much talk around women's hormonal health, but most women are left even more confused about what it means for them and what the hell to do about that. So shit shows, let's leave this confusion behind as we head into the holiday season, shall we? Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. And Happy Mammoth, the company that produces Hormone Harmony, is famous for its zero compromise policy. No GMOs, artificial fillers or flavor or any other junk. Only science-backed ingredients in amounts that are clinically proven. So this holiday season, give yourself or the woman in your life the gift of wellness. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That is happymammoth.com, code adultchild for 15% off today. All right, shit shows, did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps? It affects 1 in 3 adults and especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, brain fog, weakness, brittle nails, but the problem is that most people don't realize that low iron may be the cause of these issues. That's why I'm here to tell you about Siderol from Pharma Nutra. This is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while also avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea, constipation, and all that fun stuff. It is clinically proven to be comparable to IV iron and is formulated with just 2 ingredients, iron and vitamin C. It's vegan, allergen-free, gluten-free. You can take it anytime, anywhere. So if you're that 1 out of 3 with an iron deficiency, head to pharmanutra-us.com and use code adultchild for 10% off your first order. That is pharmanutra-us.com, promo code adultchild for 10% off today. All right, shit shows, the holidays are here. And if you still have names on your list, if you have gifts that you still need to buy, what the heck are you doing? Okay, because I've been telling you about Uncommon Goods for the past 2 months, who make holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. They look for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade. And they have something for everyone, for mom, dad, kids, teens, book lovers, sports fans, foodies, you name it, they got it. Listen to what I just stumbled upon. I just stumbled upon a crochet your own emotional support desk plant kit, a DIY kit for you to be able to crochet an emotional support desk plant. There's got to be somebody out there that has a crocheter in their life that needs this emotional support desk plant. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. And so to get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/adultchild. That's uncommongoods.com/adultchild for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Well, that's interesting because I was going to ask you, like, what was your experience? Because if they were 4 years older, like, did they go off to college? Like, was there a period of time where it was just you and your mom in the home?
Yes. My brother went off to prison.
And what age was that?
Well, he was in training school by the time he was 16 and he was in and out. But yeah, once he turned 21, he went right to prison. My oldest sister moved out pretty much a month after my father died. And then my other sister, the one I did feel close to, she went to college. And so, yeah, there was a chunk of time where I was the only one in the house with my mother. And I think at the time I did expect that I would get to know her better and I would be seen and heard more, but she checked out. It's like she just couldn't be bothered with me. Yeah. Yeah. Other people would tell me that she would brag about me, but she would never be that way with me.
How were you impacted by your father's death?
So by the time he died when I was 16. When I was 14 years old, he found a girlfriend and he was trying to stay sober. So I started to see him pretty regularly. And I would go to his place on the weekends. And it was lovely because my sisters were at an age where they had friends and jobs. So I got him all to myself and his girlfriend. And she was sweet too. And that was a good time in my life. But he couldn't stop drinking. He couldn't stay sober for long. And he got a DWI. He got mandated to a substance facility for about a month. And when he came out, he had some guy living with him. And that guy threw him a party. And so he's coming home from rehab and he comes home to his home and it's filled with people and they're all drinking and drugging. My guess is he succumbed, right? He did the same thing. And then he jumped on his motorcycle. He didn't put a helmet on and he drove down the street and he crashed. And the guy that he was living with him had called me and said, "I'm having a party for your dad. Why don't you come?" I didn't know where my dad was. So I arrive and there's all these people in his house. I don't know who they are. Some sketchy looking people. And they're all kind of quiet. And they said that, you know, they had just learned that his motorcycle crashed. So I drove down the street. I saw the ambulance. They had just put him in it. I followed the ambulance to this hospital. It was quiet and calm. Doctors were nice. They were sweet. It was quiet and calm until it wasn't, until my family arrived. And then drunk people started arriving at the hospital and the police had to be called because all these people that were drunk at his house wanted to know, "Where's Huey? Where's Huey?" Banging on the windows. And it was just a mess. My sister had to be medicated because she wanted to see my father, but he had already passed. Mm. They couldn't even perform surgery. His brain was demolished. So it was pretty tragic, right? But I couldn't grieve because I didn't know how, right? And we just didn't talk about it. If I talked about my father's death to any of my friends, it was very intellectual. You know, I had already become that little adult, you know, I was the one like, "Well, you know, he had a tough life, my dad." And I'm 16 saying this, like, "He had a tough life, my dad." I became like my mother.
What do you know about your parents' upbringings?
I don't know that much about my father's. My aunts, I don't think are reliable historians.
But one of eight, right? Is that what you said?
He was the only boy.
Interesting.
And my sense is that my nana, my paternal grandmother, she didn't know how to be affectionate. She wasn't cruel, but she didn't know how to be affectionate. She was adopted as a young kid. So she had all these children, right? She just didn't know how to be affectionate. And I think I heard someone say that she saw my father as weak. And my grandfather just worked. So I think my father was just kind of lost. My mother had a brother 10 years older than her and a brother 10 years younger than her. And my grandmother, who had narcissistic personality disorder, she was married four times. She was born in 1905 and married four times, wow, which is unheard of, right?
Yes.
She'd marry someone. She didn't pick well because they were either a gambler or a drunk. But when she married them, she would send her kid off to boarding school so she could be with this man. And she did that with each child. She did it with my mother. She sent her off to boarding school when she found my mother's father. And my grandmother had this delusion that she was going to birth a prodigy. So she believed that her kids were all destined to become either a movie star or my mother was a singer. But when it didn't happen, my grandmother would become irate. She'd get pissed. She'd either divorce the husband and find somebody new. And this is the person we're going to move to Hollywood. She moved to Los Angeles. And I have an uncle who's a brilliant musician, but he didn't make it big like my grandmother expected because they have personality disorders, right? They just can't do it, right? They're just so messed up. So my mother always wanted to be a part of a family. And that's why she wouldn't let go of my father's family. And she really resented her own mother. She would always say her mother was a terrible, terrible woman. And while she was, I suspect my mother was not an easy daughter. I think my mother was probably a lot like my oldest sister, and that's why she would condone a lot of my sister's abuse. She wouldn't intervene. She wouldn't say anything. And I do think it's because she saw herself in my sister. So my mother couldn't stand her mother. And I think that's what set in motion for her, I'm going to be the most amazing mother on the planet.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a nice segue, because before we started officially recording, you were saying that your current therapist kind of helps break down, you know, certain experiences that you had so that you are actually able to see just like the covert narcissism or how fucked up it really is. And I'm curious if you have an example of something.
An example. What were we talking about the other day? So one thing that I shared with her is I remember my sister got expelled from high school. And my mother had to go to the swearing.
Wow.
And she doesn't care. Who. No one is above her. She doesn't care.
Your oldest sister, the older one?
Yeah. And so my mother had to go to the school. And what my mother did was she went into the principal's office and she proceeded to tell the principal what my sister's punishment was going to be. Because being expelled wasn't enough. That was, right, you're incompetent, right? That's not a good enough punishment. So I'm going to one up you. And my mother said, I think seeing how you're expelling her, she should have to write like a 5-page paper on why education is of value. And so that's an example of my mother coming into a scene and taking control of it so she could look good. Like, see how smart she is? See what she's going to take it and elevate it to a whole new level because you just didn't do a good enough job. But the way she would frame it was, well, your sister needs to learn, Kelly. And I'd be like, you know what? Yeah, she does, doesn't she? You're right, Mom. You're so right. You're so smart. But what I see now is that if there was an opportunity for her to show how much of a good parent she was, she would. Yet the irony was in that scene, it was your daughter just got expelled. Like, how good of a parent are you when your daughter is so out of control? But that was just one example of how hard I am on myself and I don't ask for help. You know, she would watch me. So I guess another example was she'd have me do something that was way beyond my years. And then she'd just watch. And I always thought that she wanted to make sure I was doing a good job, but she was withholding. She wouldn't really say anything. She wouldn't say if you did or if you didn't. Well, if you screwed it up, she'd let you know. And I can see now how that was actually kind of almost sadistic because I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you're upset, you know, you want someone to show up to help see you through those tough feelings. But she couldn't be bothered. Like, you know, like, grow up. What do you want from me? You know, like, go get a job. You want that? Go get a job. She was a drill sergeant. She wasn't nurturing at all. But she had a story that was, I do everything I do for you. So stop complaining. And so now she helps me see how, I guess if you're a boss, maybe that would be good approach with your subordinates, but not with your children.
Mm-hmm. Was it not until your mother passed away that you were able to really start to see her more clearly? Or were there moments while she was still alive as well?
Yeah. So I've always had some kind of knowing that something is fundamentally wrong. No, let me be more specific. Because my grandmother's narcissism was so obvious. I knew that there was narcissism in my family. I just couldn't see the evidence. I didn't know what to look for. And plus, my own vision was so clouded. But yeah, I started to kind of come out of the fog a little bit. I watched my mother do some really messed up things that last month of her life. And my aunt calls and she's on speakerphone. And my mother says, why don't you come over for dinner? Trisha's making dinner. And Trisha says, Mom, I'm not sure if I have enough. And then my aunt hears that and says, no, it's okay. It's okay. And they hang up. And then my mother turns to my sister and she says, thanks a fucking lot. You totally made me look like a fucking asshole. Like, who does that? Like, that's abusive. And I could see it, like, and it pained me so much. Like, but what am I going to say? Like, I left the house. I would leave the house often. What do you say? She's dying, right? Like, it was too late to say anything, right? And I did feel for my sister, but she, if I went to her and asked, how are you doing? She'd be like, well, I'm fine.
Hmm.
And maybe she was. Maybe I was the one that wasn't fine, right? And I was trying to console her, but she wouldn't let me, right? They wouldn't let me console them, but I was probably projecting my own pain that I was feeling, just assuming they were too, but.
When was the first time that you sought help for yourself?
When I was about in my early 20s, I went to college. I was in Colorado. I was away from my family for the first time for an extended period of time. And I started to notice things about the way, like things that were coming up in the space between my relationships with new people I was meeting. And I started to suspect.
How, like what exactly?
So I can remember I was working in this bar, and a guy who I'd become friends with had said to me, no, I know you, Kelly, you know, you don't let anybody get close to you. It's like, I don't. And I was like, you know what? Actually, he's right. I don't. Why not? What's wrong with me? And I went back home and I started going to counseling, but I attributed it to, I thought it was because of the sexual abuse with my brother. I didn't think it was about my father. You know, I didn't think it was about my mother because I still couldn't see the covert, you know, narcissism. So I attributed it to, must be because of that sexual abuse. I went to counseling. I did EMDR for sexual abuse and thought I had that all wrapped up. So yeah, I was in my 20s and I never really stopped. And I've had a bunch of counselors. None of them, I mean, I can't fault them. I mean, I couldn't see it myself, but none of them picked up on, you know, not the narcissism in my family, or none of them did, you know.
Was it helpful? Like, do you feel like through doing that, like, did you see a difference in like the way in which you related with other people?
No, I did not. So I guess in that regard, it wasn't helpful. Aside from that particular experience, most of the time when I had a therapist, it just became banter. Like, I'm not a health, you know, mental health counselor. It became banter about that. I would just, but it probably was me intellectualizing, and they met me where I was at, right? So we didn't do any somatic work. We didn't do any mindful, like, let's try and get in touch with your emotions. No, never. And my first therapist, who I was with the longest, rarely would speak. And if I didn't speak, we sat in silence. Mm-hmm. And there were some days where I wouldn't speak. He rarely spoke. But he also was the same therapist that I learned later on that he was having inappropriate sexual relations with some of his clients. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. And in hindsight, I think, yeah, you know what? The most animated that guy ever got was when one time I was telling about how I was having sex with some guy in my best friend's bathroom floor. And this man had so many questions for me.
Of course he did.
It was, even at the time, it didn't register to me. But in hindsight, it's like, the bitch.
Mm.
Yeah.
So did you have many relationships before you met your husband?
Not that many. The ones I did have lasted a while. The one that lasted the longest was right before my husband, was with someone that was 27 years older than me. In that relationship, I met him when I was 21. It ended when I was 26 or 27. Right. And it ended because I just walked away. Like, I'm all done. Like, yeah, I felt bad about that because I think at the time I thought I was going to save him because he had a serious drug and alcohol problem. And he had bipolar disorder, like classic. But I mean, I guess I just needed to go through it. You know, I don't know if it was a father figure thing. I don't know what it was. I guess I just needed to go through it. I had a hard time letting go. It should have ended a year in, but I couldn't let go. And I don't think he could either, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up killing himself.
Wow. Yeah, how long after the relationship ended?
Maybe, let's see, I met my husband maybe 2 years after we ended, maybe 12 or 15 years later. He had met someone else.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how has all of this stuff showed up in the relationship with your husband?
All right. So let's see. I call my husband Clint Eastwood. He's very stoic. And at the time I met him, he's exactly what my unconscious was looking for, because my unconscious is always running my life because I can't face reality, right? So it would do it for me. And I needed to feel safe.
Mm.
And Sam is like bald. He's got a goatee. He's super tall. I mean, he looks like a bouncer on a Maury Povich talk show. Like, he really does. Like,
he's Steve from Jerry Springer.
Yeah. So, and he did a great job making me feel safe. Then I needed more, right? Like, maybe 7 years into our marriage, I'm like, I need to see some humbleness, right? I need to see something other than laughter and anger. But he never was that guy. So I had to change, you know, I had to figure out how to make this work. And, but he has too, like, you know, we went to counseling for a bit. We learned how to communicate. We both agree, like, we have no idea how to communicate well. We don't know how to have a healthy adult relationship. So we both could agree on that. and then try and like learn, right? But sometimes it got funky because as a therapist, sometimes he would react to me like, you know, I'm not your client, Kelly. Mm-hmm. Like if I talk to him about like, you know, like pastor being passive aggressive right now, you know? So I had to figure out a way to approach him where I didn't make him feel like I knew something he didn't. That's how it works, I think. And now our relationship is even stronger because he's the only person that's come into my life that's been in long enough to see what my family is like. Because you have to be around for a while to see it. It's so subtle. But he did. And he loved my family. He loved my middle sister, especially because she's the good time girl. She loves to have a good time. And Sam did too, right? So it's been hard for him, I think. But it's been not for what he lost in terms of my family, but in watching me cry all the time. And now I'm doing this work and I'm doing all these meetings through the shit show. And it's not his journey. And he's not inclined to ask me about it. Because if he did and I talked, I think sometimes he's like, too much information. I don't know what to do with that. You know? Yeah, I know I am blessed because it's a freaking miracle that something in me saw something in him and decided I want to marry this guy when I was 30. Mm. So it is like a miracle. I don't know, like, because I really should be in an institution.
No, no, no. Can you talk about why the article that I wrote about when your inner critic doesn't have a voice was so impactful to you?
So because all these years since I was 20 years old, you know, and I met Dr. Willoughby and I learned about ACA stuff, I have taken a cognitive approach to my own journey. I kept thinking, I'm just going to read every book. I'm going to learn what this is about. And then I will then be healed. And so I practice affirmations. I do mantras. I challenge my thoughts. I challenge my core beliefs, right? I still have like that the depression in me. And yeah, I still have that critic. It's just so loud. That didn't ever stop. And that article, Carmen, right? She talked.
No, I wrote it.
Yeah, but it was after a...
Yeah, yeah. It was about her episode. Uh-huh.
Right. It said, you just have to show up and be vulnerable because you couldn't do that in your childhood. You lived in a world where the harm was in the air and it was your voice was silenced. And so you've got a voice, you have a lot to say. And so that's what you have to do. Like you need to go take risks with people and share your truth and experience what you experience when someone is holding that space for you. And I've been doing it for others, right? But never thought like, oh, I need that. I need that. And that makes sense to me. It also takes me off the hook, right? For a little while in terms of, all right, so it's not that I'm doing this wrong, that I know here's evidence that I must be fundamentally flawed because I'm 58 years old, I'm a therapist, and I am still a fucking mess. And I don't know, something about reading that and how the subtlety of the emotional abandonment is, you know, that healing is found in a relation, in a connection with another human, but one that you feel safe with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, okay, that I can do because I can breathe all day long, but I am not going to have an epiphany from breathing. I'm not. It's not. I know me. I know it's not. I'm just going to be like, okay, I'm breathing. What's next?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it. But now I'm thinking, I'm not just being a pompous know-it-all and I'm not just being resistant. It's actually true. I do know myself, except for this one piece, right? Like my unconscious is what brought me to the shit show.
Mm-hmm.
It knows me better than I know myself because that's what narcissism does. It doesn't get me to question other people or the world. It got me to doubt myself. That article just said, you're doing the right thing, Kelly. Keep on the right track. Just keep doing this. You're okay. Don't worry about any of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just got to show up and try to resist filtering my words and close my eyes and just speak whatever comes. Because I'm good at filtering my words, checking how I sound, right? I was groomed. And
I've always thought that you've spoken very honestly and non-filtered.
Yes, right. And I'm sure I do, but I still have it. No, mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. No matter what anyone says about me, I'm going to, yeah, but maybe not.
Maybe, exactly. I'm lying.
Yeah.
Well, it's been so amazing watching you grow. I mean, I've seen so much growth. It's been really beautiful.
I feel it. I feel it. And I get to, you know, and even with my clients, like I know some of my clients say, like, they don't say, they expect healing means they're happy. and there are no more problems. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it means. Like, it's still going to be hard and there's still going to be pain. And that's the truth. I experienced that, but yet it's better. It is better. It's like certain needs get met and new needs now come in and take, but it's a different kind of need. It's like a higher, like Maslow's hierarchy. It's a higher level. Like, the quality of my life is going to change because of it. And I can see it. I still have self-doubt.
Yeah. And you know what? It's probably always going to be there to an extent.
Yeah,
you know?
I think so too. Yeah. So I love the shit show.
Well, I love having you there. Give me three things that you like about yourself.
My curiosity, my courage, and my love of music.
Okay.
I love music.
Hope we're doing for the future.
Hope for the future. I hope that I can feel free inside, right? I can feel a sense of freedom about myself and within myself. I want to feel free. That word is just important to me. Like, I want to feel, not just feel free. I want to be free, which means be in the moment, right? That's what I hope. I also hope that my sisters find their way.
Have either one of them ever been to therapy?
No, but they both, well, the oldest claims like she worked through her shit. Mm-hmm. But when she said it, hey, I worked through my shit. Like, are you sure? Like, I mean, just the way you're still an asshole. Right. The other one is a yoga instructor. So she's all about, you know, eeny, meeny, bo, beeny.
Yeah, spiritual bypassing.
So she would say that's her counseling.
Well, thank you, Kelly. This was great.
Thank you. This was huge for me.
All right, shit shows. Breathe to Heal is officially back, and this time we're going deeper than ever before. The theme of this third round is release and receive, releasing everything that's been stuck for way too long so you can finally receive the peace, love, and safety I know you've been craving. The 7-week healing journey goes beyond talk therapy by working directly with your nervous system using breathwork, somatic practices, and parts work to give you the kind of healing your body has been waiting for. This is all facilitated by fellow shit show member and certified somatic and breathwork practitioner Teresa, who's just added some fresh breathwork certifications to her toolkit. And the best part of all, this all happens right within the shit show healing community. So think of it like a healing journey where you can show up exactly as you are, like you're hanging out with your friends on the couch in your pajamas, instead of feeling like you're in some stuffy environment. So this all kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th, and early bird pricing is on through December 11th. So you, yes you, the person that's been wanting to sign up for the past two rounds but hasn't, how about we do the damn thing already, okay? Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end. adultchildpodcast.com/BREATHE to heal to learn more and grab your damn spot.